When we talk about a biblical worldview, for me, it's rooted and grounded in what the gospel is and teaching you how to rightly interpret the Bible in one hand and use the Bible to rightly interpret a newspaper that you might hold in the other hand and show you how the two relate, how the Bible and the gospel actually shed light on the headlines of what we see around us. It sheds light on what people in our classes at school might say, what our teachers might say, what we might face at college. So I want to pray for us. And before I do, if you have your Bibles, if you would turn to Colossians chapter 2, and I want to read a few verses to you. And it's actually the verses I'm going to read are a prayer. Now, I know, Chris, you were in this session last year. Is there anyone else that was in the worldview session last year? Okay, we've got a few people. I'll try to mix up the content a little bit, but essentially the way we're doing D3 is that you get kind of the same core every year. And so if you're back in here, I hope it's a good, there will be some new stuff, but I hope it's a good reinforcement of some of the things we talked about last year. So Colossians chapter 2, this is the Apostle Paul speaking to young believers in a very secular context. And so they were in a situation in which the outside world thought they were crazy for what they believed, and there were even people on the inside of the church who were trying to redefine what Christianity was all about and redefine the nature of God. And so this is a church that's very similar to the experiences we have in churches today. I mean, we're situated in a progressively secular context or context, and we even have people that will come into the church and try to redefine who the church is and what the church believes. If you've never experienced this, you probably will at some point in your lifetime. We actually had to church discipline a member of our church who had joined a cult. And he had fallen in line with a former Baptist missionary who believed that he had discovered certain biblical manuscripts that no one had ever discovered before that described that the name of God is Yah, and everyone who is saved must be saved in the name of Yah. Everyone who is a follower of Yah receives a new name that would be like, my name's Dan, so my name might be like Yah Ben Dan or something like that. Very odd. And this missionary, of course, the manuscripts he received that didn't make it into the Bible were lost, right? Which is, you know, yeah, that, absolutely. So he lost it. You're fine. You can interrupt at any point. If anybody has a question, feel free to raise your hand as we go on. But he believed that no one who was not saved in the name of Yah was actually a Christian. So we had to kick him out. And that would be an example of someone inside the church trying to redefine the church's message. And so we have that in our world today. And we also have the outside world that looks at us and thinks we're kind of crazy and tries to show how we're crazy. And often they do that by misrepresenting us, whether intentionally or unintentionally. It's not always intentional, but they misrepresent what we believe. So this church had to fight to keep people on the inside understanding what the gospel is and keep people on the outside to answer objections and myths about what Christians actually believe. So Paul writes to them, and he says in Colossians chapter 2, verse 1, or actually verse 4, he says, I'm sorry, we're going to start in verse 1. I spoke at a youth camp that ended Monday morning, and I drove straight here to be here last night, which I live here. But so if it takes me a little while to get all my thoughts and words kind of in sequence, just hang with me. All right, Colossians 2, 1. Paul writes, "For I want you to know how great a struggle I have for you and those in Laodicea." Now, the struggle he's talking about is not a physical skirmish. It's not a physical fight. He's not actually fighting with people. The struggle he has, as he describes later in Colossians, is a struggle in prayer. In Ephesians, Paul says, "We wrestle not with flesh and blood, but with what? Powers and principalities." So he's wrestling with spiritual forces here through prayer. So he says, I'm struggling for you. This is another way of saying I'm praying for you and for all those who've not seen me in person. I want their hearts to be encouraged and joined together in love so that they may have all the riches of assured understanding and have the knowledge of God's mystery, Christ, all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge are hidden in Him. Like a good Baptist sermon, Paul's prayer has three basic points, and here they are. The first thing he prays for them is that they would be encouraged. As they face the secularism of their day, and as they face people on the inside who would often try to redefine the core of the gospel, Paul begins by praying that he doesn't want them to be discouraged. Now, that's kind of interesting. You'd think Paul would lead with, I want you to always know truth, right? Or something like that. If you were in a, perhaps you're in a biology class at your school, and you have a professor or a teacher who says he's an atheist, and he's trying to shove a certain worldview, perhaps, kind of put it in your face. And he finds it kind of laughable what you happen to believe. If I were to write you a letter and said, look, my main prayer for you is that you be encouraged, could that maybe seem a little odd? Here's the point I think Paul's making here. When we are discouraged spiritually, we are more vulnerable to the attacks of Satan. And we are discouraged spiritually, we're more vulnerable to lies and deception. A recent article came out in The Atlantic by a guy named Larry Taunton. And Larry Taunton is a Christian. He runs a ministry with Fixed Point Ministry. They sponsor debates. Have any of you guys heard of Christopher Hitchens? He was a famous atheist, journalist, dual citizenship. He had a British citizenship and then took an American citizenship after 9/11, after the terrorist attacks. And so anyways, Larry Taunton's been around atheists. He has good friends who are skeptics and sponsors these debates. And he published an article with a very well-known secular newspaper. And the title of the article was What Evangelicals Can Learn from Young Atheists. And he published this survey, and I'm going to give you, and this is all to illustrate this prayer about encouragement, so I hope this makes sense. He did a nationwide survey with students who were at college who described themselves as atheists. And over a period of a year, he traveled to hundreds or scores, I'm not sure how many, to a bunch of college campuses, and he would go to what they call the Secular Student Society or the Society of Free Thinkers. Every campus has something like that, and it's usually basically people who would claim to be atheist or agnostic or skeptics in some flavor, one flavor or another. And he had six observations about all of these students that he gave, and I want to share those with you now. Okay, the first observation that he gave is that most of them had a church background. Most of the people who are in skeptic student organizations on college campuses who claim to be atheists had some church background. Okay, if you're taking notes, that's the first one. They had attended church. But I'd also say I have this published on my blog, which is Theo, like theology, and latte, like Starbucks. So put those together, Theo latte, and it's on there as well. So the first one, they had attended church. The second one, the mission and message of their churches was vague. The mission and message of their churches was vague. Now, there are some words that I might use that you don't hear on a regular basis. So what I'll try to do is describe those. Vague is a word you're probably familiar with, but what he's simply saying is that when they talked about their church, these are atheists, when they talked about the church they attended, they said that the message of their church was unclear. In other words, they were uncertain what exactly their church believed, and they were uncertain exactly what their church taught. So first, they had attended church. Second, the mission and message of their churches was vague. And third, they felt their churches offered superficial answers to life's difficult questions. They felt their churches offered superficial answers to life's difficult questions. So the church, they'd attended church, the message of their church was unclear. They felt their church offered superficial, which means on the surface, not very deep, not very sophisticated, not very informed. They offered these kind of easy answers to really difficult questions. So instead of grappling with deep questions and thinking about them and having what some might consider kind of an informed response, they would just throw out something kind of easy that wouldn't be that helpful. Okay, number four. The students who were atheists, who affiliated with these secular student societies, said that they expressed their respect for those ministers who took their Bibles seriously. So here's what they're saying. When they look back at their church, that their church's mission was generally vague. The church was giving superficial answers that weren't that helpful to really deep questions instead of giving serious consideration to the questions. And then finally, when they met a Christian who took their Bible seriously, they actually respected someone like that, whose mission would be clear, whose message would be clear, who wouldn't give superficial answers, who would actually try to deal with the questions. So they respected people like that. Number five, ages 14 to 17 were decisive. Most of the students that Larry interviewed in his article and in his survey work, it was between the ages of 14 and 17 that they began seeing themselves as skeptic or atheist or as agnostic. Now, for many of them, they would not vocalize that until later, until they got to college. But when they got to college and came out as an atheist, they would say it was really back around the time of their sophomore, junior, and senior year when they started seeing themselves that way. And number six, and this illustrates the point of Paul's prayer that I'm trying to make, the final point Larry Taunton makes in his article is that their decision to embrace unbelief was often an emotional one. Their decision to embrace unbelief was often an emotional one. So here, Paul prays that their hearts would be encouraged. Isn't it interesting, after he interviews all these atheists, that he says that one of the key things when they were 14 to 17 was really important, and that their decision to leave Christianity was really an emotional one. Now, I didn't intend to give you this morning. I'm adding a little more into this, but we'll just trust that the Spirit's leading and it's not a lack of caffeine here. But I want to give you a few things related to this before we move on to the second part of Paul's prayer. I was just going to read this passage and pray, but obviously that has not happened. So Tim Keller, who's a pastor, we gave you guys his book. Chris, is that the book we gave you last year, The Reason for God? Okay. Yeah, Tim Keller's a pastor in New York, really helpful on most subjects. But he says there are three reasons why people either believe or don't believe. So whether it's a Muslim, a Jew, a Christian, an atheist, a Buddhist, that there are three primary reasons they either choose to believe those things or not to believe them. The first one is for intellectual reasons. The first reason they choose to believe or not believe is for intellectual reasons. Now, that doesn't mean that's the greatest reason. These are not in order of how people actually make decisions, but these are just three reasons given in kind of a random order, okay? So people choose to believe things or not believe things for intellectual reasons. The second one is people choose to believe things or not believe things because of social reasons. Now, the truth is, out of these three things, all three of them factor into everybody's decision. Okay, when you became a Christian, there were intellectual reasons for you believing Christianity, and there were also social reasons. Sociologists, people who study the way people, and sociology by and large is led by non-believers, so you want to be careful when you, like, you know, pull principles from that. But sociologists call this plausibility structures. Okay, if something's plausible, what does that mean? If something's plausible. Yes, sir. It's a possibility. So if something's plausible, does it mean it's true just because it's plausible? No. Okay, so if I walk into the kitchen and there's milk all over the floor, and one of my twins, I have three sons and one daughter, and one of my twins, the twins are 6 and a half, one of my twins says is standing there, Micah, we'll say. Micah's standing there and there's just milk spilled all over the floor. And he has a three-month-old baby sister, Adeline. And Adeline's in this little rocking chair. And I say, Micah, what happened? And he said, well, Addie was kind of rocking in her chair, and it hit the refrigerator really hard, and it made the door swing open, and the milk fell out and spilled everywhere. Is that at least kind of remotely plausible? Maybe, but kind of not. What's more plausible? That Micah spilled it, okay? So plausible doesn't mean something's true. It just means, okay, that maybe fits. So something can be more or less plausible. Like you might score something as a 10 on a plausibility scale or as a 3, but it would still be plausible. Okay, the reason sociologists call the people, like say your family, if they're Christians, they call it a plausibility structure. That when you think about Christianity, there are people you know, love, and respect who believe in this. And because people you love and respect believe in it, it makes it seem more what? More believable, more plausible. And so there are social reasons for believing what you believe. Do those social reasons make it true? No, but it can make it more plausible. If you grew up in Switzerland, atheism would probably seem more plausible to you than Christianity would. That doesn't mean it's true. That just means the people around you generally hold to some form of atheism. So there are intellectual reasons, social reasons, and then the third thing Tim Keller says is there are emotional reasons. There are emotional reasons. So Larry Taunton, in his article, his final point was, most of the students who left Christianity for atheism did so for emotional reasons. Now, out of those three reasons, which ones do you think are the most important? Intellectual, social, and emotional. Okay. Why would intellectual be the most important? Yeah. Yeah. So ultimately, your worldview claim, what you believe, should be based on what is true. Now, let me ask you this. What's more powerful of the three? Intellectual. I'm just saying, I'm not talking about theoretical, but what in everyday life of a person has more influence on what they believe? Social and emotional. Why? Why do you think, no wrong answer here. Why do you think that would be the case? Yeah. Yeah. Okay, good. Other thoughts on that? Peer pressure. Yeah, good. Now let's talk about the emotional one for a second. So that's the social. Have you ever known someone? I watched a video on YouTube and last night someone sent it to me. One of our professors sent it to me. And it's of a pastor who has a hissy fit with his congregation. And he starts walking around telling people's sins, like, and Brother Ralph, you used to run around on your wife, and it's like, you're watching, and then the kid who's running the video camera, and he goes, and you know, Jim Bob back there in the video camera, I'm going to fix your attitude, son. And then he looks at his mom and goes, and Mama, you don't get in my way either. You stay out. And he said, he just goes on this tirade, and this guy's probably, hopefully, going to be run out of that church because that is just not a healthy way. He just throws a absolute fit. And he's walking down the aisle at one point, and he says, and you. I mean, like, he is looking around for people to go after, and he goes, and you, where have you been for the last 2 months? You haven't been in church. And he's sitting next to his fiance, and he goes, and you think I'm going to marry you to her? Why do you want to marry this kind of loser? And he's just going off like that. Do you think some people would leave the church over that? Yeah.
They're calling your fiance a loser?
Yeah, absolutely. Do you think emotional reasons can really have a strong influence on why we believe or don't believe?
Some more than others.
Yeah, absolutely. What if you're at a church and it comes out that the pastor has been committing adultery with several women in the church? Do you think that might lead some people in the church to... You say, you know what, I don't have anything to do with that. Is that an intellectual reason or an emotional reason? It is kind of both. I would say it's more an emotional reason because they're not leaving because they necessarily have found intellectual reasons to reject Christianity. You know what I mean? It's not like someone discovered the body of Jesus still in a tomb somewhere in the Middle East. They haven't had like new evidence that would lead them away from Christianity. It's emotional reasons. So that's what Tim Keller says here, and Paul is praying that you would be encouraged. Doesn't Paul's prayer make a little more sense in light of all of that? Okay, so here's the second thing. that their hearts might be encouraged and joined together in love. And so we have, well, I think you could argue, Paul is arguing that they would not be led away emotionally, that they would be encouraged. Do you see that? I'm praying that you would be encouraged. So I think Paul's praying against these emotional decisions. We're going to see social in the next one. He says, I'm praying that your hearts may be encouraged and joined together in love. Whose hearts joined to, whose hearts is he talking about here? Christians. Okay, more specifically than that in his letter. Now, they are Christians, but it's not just all Christians. What Christians does he want their hearts to be joined to? Colossians. And so in this church, Paul's praying that they be encouraged and that their hearts will be united in love with other Christians in their local church. So you see emotional, Paul's praying that they be encouraged. You see social. He's praying that they would have a unity in the church where they love one another. And the way they would describe their relationships to one another would be that they are united in love. Okay, here's the third thing. You also see intellectual reasons. Watch this. Paul says, praying that they be encouraged, their hearts joined in love, so they may have all the riches of assured understanding, intellectual reasons, and have the knowledge of God's mystery, Christ. So the intellectual reasons for the Christian faith are rooted and grounded in the historical person and work of Jesus Christ. So Paul says, I want you to be encouraged, emotional. I want you to be united in love, social. And I want you to understand the truth of the gospel, Jesus Christ, intellectual. And we see that the gospel covers all three. That's Paul's prayer for the Colossian believers. That's my prayer for you. Did not mean to go that long in describing Paul's prayer, but I'm going to pray for you now. And then I want to give you a few kind of highlights I'm going to try and hit in our time together over the next few days. Before I pray, I just want to plant one little thought for you to consider. I would like to address questions you have. So every day, I'll take Q&A at the end, so I'll make sure I have enough time at the end to do Q&A. And then the second thing, I would like to take, after the prayer time, I'd like to hear a few things from you that you hope I cover in class. So I'm just going to make a note of them and try to cover them as we go along. All right? Let's pray. Father, we thank you for your truth. We recognize that your gospel is true, that your gospel is the story of what Jesus has done in time and space and history, in his life and death and burial and resurrection. God, we recognize that if the resurrection isn't true, then we are more to be pitied than anyone else. But we thank you that you raised your Son from the dead and that Christianity is a living faith because you're a living God and you raised your Son from the dead. God, I pray that you would help our hearts to be encouraged. I pray that our hearts would be united in love with other believers from our local churches and even here this week so that we might know the fullness and the glory of the gospel. It's in Jesus' name we pray. Amen. All right, I'm going to need to borrow a pen from someone. Thanks, Chris. How many of you guys were at the, is it Renown? We changed the name this year. How many of you guys were at the Renown Conference? Okay, did anybody go to my session at the Renown Conference? Okay, we have one person. Okay, Chris was in that session. Chris just graduated from a school in Indianapolis and had an opportunity at a non-religious private school. Is that a fair way to describe it? A very prestigious non-religious private school. I drove to hear Chris speak in a session, and he was a part of a scholars program where they write an essay. And he wrote his essay on the resurrection, the historical reasons for believing in the resurrection. His paper ended up being how long? 191 pages. And the session before his, they had to give it publicly, and they had to have a panel made up of a lot of your teachers, and I had the privilege to be on the panel, which was really cool to be there. And then students would come and listen. The panel before him, the student had an essay about tennis shoes, right? Like, which ones are better? Which sounds funny, but it was actually interesting. I mean, he did a lot of research on which ones are better. And there was a moderate-sized crowd for that one. For Chris's, there were how many over, like three overflow rooms? Yeah. It was a packed room beyond capacity, and they actually had to ask some people to leave. And they had three overflow rooms. And so Chris stood up and with boldness shared the historical reasons for believing in the resurrection. And then they did open mic Q&A. Unfiltered, unedited, anybody could ask anything they want. And there was a Jewish man, a Hindu man, a Muslim man, an atheist, I think one of your classmates. And anyway, so at some point I might have Chris come up and share some stuff from that. If nothing else, do some Q&A about sharing the gospel in environments like that. But anyways, I said all that because Chris gave me a pen. That's just how my mind works. Okay. What are some things you hope we cover in our time together? What questions do you have that you hope we cover? And if you can't think of any now, I'm sure you'll think of some as we go on. Yes, sir. Okay. How to answer combative atheists.
Like when they don't really want to hear your side story.
Yeah. No, that's good. Do you have some friends who are combative atheists? Okay. Yes, ma'am.
Mm-hmm. Okay,
good. Okay. Tim.
We've got a lot of seniors and juniors in our group, I know. So I guess going to like a secular college, what does it look like to stay strong in your faith there?
Yeah. Yeah, I take a trip, a group of students to Boston every May, and we spend time at Harvard, MIT, and Boston College, and then we had this year a grad student from Yale, come and spend time with our group too. But our students get to hang out with grad and post-grad, so master's students and PhD students from Harvard, MIT, and Boston College, and Yale, who are all strong believers, and it is possible in any environment. Spiritual flourishing is possible in any environment, and apostasy, which means leaving the Christian faith, is possible in any environment. And so, but we will talk about that. That's good.
Well, I wouldn't like to learn how to say, not just a combative atheist, or not just like any atheist, but like any other religion.
Okay.
I'd like to know how to keep my side of the story.
Yeah, good. Okay. Couple more. Yes, ma'am.
Well, I try to talk to someone who kind of has the Oprah Winfrey view. Mm-hmm. The gospel just kind of can believe whatever you want and all leads to God. And just kind of, you know, pinpoint Jesus as the only way.
Okay. Good. You again.
I'd like to know why kids like the taste of cinnamon toast crunch.
Because it's sweet. Yeah.
Coming on as harsh and condemning them.
Yeah. Very good. Yes, sir.
How do you deal with somebody who thinks that what you call you a hater because you know and you tell them that they're wrong?
Yeah. Yeah, and that's just going to become more of an issue on every, you know. Louis Giglio preached a sermon 15 years ago. Was the last time he preached on homosexuality. And he did it in a loving and winsome way. And that was enough for them to keep him from praying at President Obama's reelection.
15 years.
Yeah, they went back and found it. So I think that, I know you're talking about salvation specifically, but I think our culture's going to be more, will more quickly use the hater label. All right, good. Well, that's not good, but you know what I mean. Okay, so, what? Yes, sir. Okay.
Not atheists, they just say, like, what you're saying might be true, I'll think about it, but they want to challenge everything you say.
Yeah. Okay, good. Okay, I'm going to stop with that, and then we will look at questions that you guys have as we go along. And now what I need to do is make sure that we're on track. We go till noon, which we won't go that long. I'll make sure we take a break. So we've got a little more time. Here's what I would like to do for the rest of our time together. I want to give you 8 questions to ask of any worldview, and it comes from this book, which we gave you all a copy of. And James Sayer, you have his bio on the back. Let's see. He's an editor, a writer, a speaker. This is the best book I've ever used on worldview. I absolutely love this book. And so what James Sayer does is he gives you 8 questions to ask of any worldview, and then he goes through 8 worldviews and asks those 8 questions of each of them. So it's really helpful. Now, the main thing James Sayer is interested in is looking at the coherence of a biblical worldview. What do you think coherence means? It's clarity. Okay. What else? That's true. That's good.
Consistency.
And so James Sayer isn't first and foremost trying to disprove a worldview. He's just trying to say, if it is true, what will be consistent in keeping with that worldview? Does that make sense? And so one of the ways you can evaluate a worldview, and I try to do this from time to time, is to step into the shoes of another way of thinking and just ask, is what they, how they live and how they act consistent with the basic premises of their worldview? So their basic commitments, is it coherent? Is it consistent? And so that's what James Sayer is really good at. So in this book, it's not a how-to guide to disprove atheism. It can be, for example, when he looks at atheism or what he calls naturalism, it can be a how-to guide to show atheists how they're living inconsistently. Does that make sense? Francis Schaeffer used to say that every worldview at some point will have, and Francis Schaeffer would argue, with the exception of Christianity, and hopefully we'll unpack that more as we go along, but every worldview at some point will come into conflict with reality. And so what people will do is they believe this, but their lived experience seems to be something else, right? Growing up, for example, you were told there was a Santa Claus. And as you got a little older, hopefully I'm not bursting anybody's bubble in here. I'll try another illustration.
Oh my gosh.
But at some point, you know, you saw Mama kissing Santa Claus by the Christmas tree or whatever, you know, you slowly started to figure out. And so you could either do one of two things. You could either embrace that reality and say, okay, Santa Claus is my dad. He puts on a suit. Or, they're all false. Or you could come up with reasons for why that, like, so the song, I Saw Mama Kissing Santa Claus Underneath the Christmas Tree or whatever. You could come up with reasons how Santa Claus could still be real and try to make an excuse for that or try to come up with some theory to get rid of that being a problem to your belief. And what Francis Schaeffer said is what people will do is they construct a roof over their head to protect them from the pressure of reality that comes down on their worldview. Does that make sense? And I'll give you one quick example. Sam Harris, anybody heard of Sam Harris? I know Chris will have, but anybody else? Sam Harris is a well-known atheist. He's a neuroscientist, so he studies the brain. He wrote a book on how science can give us a basis for ethics or morality, how science can teach us how to be good or bad. Now, the book was not very compelling for most people, even skeptics, because the book was not mostly scientific. The book claimed to prove how science would show us how to have morality, and what the book uses is a lot of philosophy. And so he makes a lot of assumptions and uses a lot of philosophy in trying to make a scientific point. But his next book, so that was a big book, his next book was a real little book. And his real little book was called, I think it was just called Free Will. And in that little book, he says that if atheism is true, then there's no way we control our own decisions. So he had a big book telling us how science proves how we can make moral decisions. The science can explain that. And then the next book, he says, it's philosophically impossible for atheists to believe that we can make meaningful decisions. Is that coherent? No. And so that's one example of saying, so what Francis Schaeffer says, people build a roof over their head to protect themselves from all this pressure. And what we as Christians need to do is come in and just take the roof off from over their head. So they have to feel the full weight of their worldview commitment. Yes, sir.
This book, is it unbiased? Like, does it seem that way? Because I was reading the back, and there's nothing really about, this is for Christianity. Like, would I give this to somebody, who doesn't necessarily believe in Christianity?
Yeah. No, I don't think this would be the kind of book that you would give a non-Christian to try to try and make Christianity seem convincing or compelling to them. This is for Christians to think through. And I do think it's unbiased because I think that he's right on in describing how a worldview would be consistent without having to say it's false.
Yeah.
Does that make sense? Now, you bring up a good question because I have a gentleman I know who's a postmodern thinker. And postmodernism, we won't have time to get to that, but he essentially believes that there's no absolute truth. So there's no overarching truth that's true for all people in all places and all times. And we talked about this book, and what postmodernists try to do is what's your name? Andrew. How old are you, Andrew? 16, and where are you from? Montgomery, Alabama. Okay. So Andrew, if you were to make a truth statement, my friend, I use that word loosely, not because of what he believes, but we've only been around each other a few times. But he's an author, and he's written a bunch of youth ministry books. And he doesn't believe there's truth, which is interesting. He speaks at a lot of youth ministry conferences. And anyways, but Andrew, he would say to you, if you made a truth claim, he would say, well, first of all, what we need to do is deconstruct or break down your statement based on the fact that you're white and 16 and probably from a middle-class family in the South. And once we take all of that away, we'll see that you really only made that statement because you're a white 16-year-old from the South. So your statement probably doesn't have that much. We have to understand that your statement apart from all those other things. So we have to tear it apart. Does that make sense? Now, your statement can be true or false whether or not you're 16 from a middle-class family in the South. But postmodernism is going to say all of those things taint your truth statement, so therefore your truth statement isn't entirely pure and true for all people. It's true for 16-year-old white kids named Andrew from the South. Does that make sense? And or at least for you, maybe not other 16-year-old white kids from the South. So we were talking about this book, and he said, well, the first thing I would like to begin doing is deconstruct James Sire. These questions are true for him, because he has a PhD from an affluent, upper-class white suburb or whatever. So there are people who would take issue with it. But I think most people who hold the different worldviews would say, James Sire actually is doing something helpful to show how our worldview's consistent, or how to be a consistent atheist, how to be a consistent Muslim, how to be a consistent Buddhist. Does that make sense? Okay. So let me give you his 8 questions. They're in your book, but I would encourage you to go ahead and take notes on this. And it says 7 questions, but he gives 8. And so I don't know why. The older copies of this book said he only had 7 questions. Now he has 8. So I'll just give you 8. The first question to ask from any worldview is, what is ultimate reality? What is ultimate reality? He also calls it prime reality. What is ultimate reality? Within that worldview, whatever worldview you're looking at. Yes, ma'am. It is. It is on page 22. Yeah, and what he does is in the first chapter, I'll make sure it's not the introduction. I think it's, in chapter 1, he lays out these 8 questions, and then in every other chapter, he uses those 8 questions as the outline for the whatever worldview it is. So the helpful thing about it, guys, is we're only going to have time in this class to really look at his framework, and then we're going to compare it to the gospel, and we're going to compare it to atheism. And so what you could do with the book is see how these 8 questions relate to deism, a view that there is a God who's not involved with the world, how it relates to nihilism, how it relates to postmodernism, how it relates to, here's a mouthful, Eastern pantheistic monism. Let's all say that together. Eastern pantheistic monism. There you go. Good. OK, Okay, so what is prime reality? What is ultimate reality? What's really real? The Christian might answer that God, or religious people who believe in multiple gods might say gods. People who are called pantheists, the word pan means many, and theism is God, theos is God, so pantheism, are there many gods. The atheist can really only answer that matter is ultimately real. I mean, that's the most common answer. There are more sophisticated answers, perhaps, but the atheist has to say that matter is real. We don't really know exactly what matter is when we say matter, but the atheist would have to say what's really real is the stuff that makes up the universe. There are new theories that instead of it being, you know, these subatomic particles, that maybe it's like actually reality is made up of strings, something called M theory that I don't really understand that much about. But ultimately, it would still boil down to something that we would fit into the description of matter. So what is really real? What is ultimate reality? We would say it's an eternal, personal, and intelligent God. The atheist would have to say it is eternal, non-intelligent, and impersonal matter. Those are the two basic building blocks for a theistic worldview and an atheistic worldview. Theism says that everything we see is the result of an eternal, intelligent, personal God. The atheist would say everything we see is the result of eternal, non-intelligent, impersonal matter. Okay, second question. So we'll look into those even more as we go. Second question, what is the nature of external reality? That is the world around us. What is the nature of external reality? So you have ultimate reality, and then you have external reality. So what's external reality? Let me start just by way of review to make sure you're all tracking with me. For the Christian, what is ultimate reality? God. So what would external reality be? Yeah, the universe. Yeah, the world that we see around us. What do Christians believe about the world we see around us? Created, okay. If it's created, what are some of the implications of the world being created?
It was designed well.
Okay. Okay, so it's designed well, but does it seem like there's something wrong with it? I mean, how do we make sense of that if we're Christians? I mean, that must really throw us for a loop, right? That the universe has all these problems. We have volcano eruptions and tornadoes, and what do we do with that? What's that?
The fall of man.
The fall of man? Who said that? Oh, right there. Okay.
The absence of God.
Okay. So creation is not in its original state as God intended. Would that be fair to say? I'm going to give you in our next session 7 effects of the fall that we find in Genesis. So I'm not going to give it to you now, but we'll look at it next time. And I think when you look at the effects, and they're all found right in Genesis chapter 2 and 3, chapters 2 and 3. But when you look at the effects of the fall, I don't see any way that we could have a problem with evil from a biblical worldview. Now, someone may say Christians have a problem with evil if they don't understand a biblical worldview. Does that make sense? But if you really put on the shoes of a Christian for someone who's not and look out at the world through a biblical worldview, you would see that evil ultimately isn't a problem. But you would also see, if we were to put on the shoes of our skeptic friends and look out at the universe, that if there is no God, there also is no evil. That what we call evil, whether moral evil, someone doing a heinous crime, or natural evil, something happens in the natural world, a shark attack or even a disease someone might have, that is not evil. That's just the universe doing what the universe does, and the cosmos doesn't care. And so is evil a problem for a Christian? No, not really. Is evil a problem for an atheist? Only if they call it evil. And only if they have moral outrage over crime, then evil is a problem, because how do they explain it? That is a really simple definition of it. And anyways, you have to be careful. For our conversation together, we're going to talk about things at kind of a surface level. if you were to talk to a skeptic, you'd have to go a little deeper. But ultimately, let me just say this, for the atheist, they either have to say there is no evil, or they have to live with tension between this feeling of outrage and longing for justice and a worldview that doesn't support it. Does that make sense? Okay, so we're kind of jumping ahead and shucking and jiving and weaving, and but it's Tuesday morning and I haven't had enough coffee yet. So what is the nature of external reality? Number three, what is a human being? What is a human being? James Sire says in his book, to this question we might answer, a highly complex machine from a naturalistic worldview. From a New Age perspective, we might say that man is a sleeping God, ready to be awakened to the God that is in you. For a Christian, we would say that a human being is a person made in the image of God, someone who buys into the complete Darwinian story. I'm going to use an expression here that you might not be familiar with, meta-narrative. Meta means overarching and narrative means story. Someone buys into the Darwinian meta-narrative, the overarching story, as the grand explanation for all things, they might say a human is just a naked ape. Not different, not substantively different. Yes, sir? What's that? Yeah, I think that the nature of what is a human being is when does a person become a human being. And I would argue that what a human being is not defined by what they are capable of doing. It's actually in their essence. And that's why Christians have historically argued, biblically and rightly argued, that a human life begins at conception, because it's in the essence of a person that defines who they are, not what they're able to do. Again, jumping around just a little bit, but the further we define a human being as what they're capable of doing, that is going to move the abortion discussion to post-birth elimination of life. And that is a slippery slope that we will continue to go down. I was sitting with a skeptic friend recently, and he's a good friend, and he's one of those guys I can have real conversations with without it being a combative atheist. Who asked about that? You know, combative atheist. He's one of those guys I can have a real conversation with and not want to go home and just beat my head against a brick wall. You know, I'm getting nowhere. And so my friends who are like that probably feel the same way maybe about me. But I try to have, for me, conversations that aim for clarity and precision and understanding are the most helpful. When it's just somebody trying to prove a point, whether it's a Christian or an atheist, that's where conversations are difficult. But when you're trying to be clear and understand and precise, they're helpful. So this is what he said. He said, you know, I've been thinking through what it means to be human. And he said, I'm pretty sure that if I follow the implications of my view of what it means to be human, it leads to a pretty scary result. And so he was considering things like brain function and comparing a newborn child's brain function to the capacity of a monkey, for example, that it would take, a baby would have to get to a certain age before it would be on par with even certain animals in terms of the way they seem to be able to function. And he just said, you know, I see where the implications of that could take me. And I'm glad that he sees that as scary. I don't want to live in a world where we define a human as someone who's able to pass an ACT or an SAT. So what does it mean to be human? These are the kind of worldview issues that have radical implications about everything we do, and they're rooted in our worldview commitments. Number four, what happens to a person at death? What happens to a person at death? So it's personal extinction, transformation to a higher state, reincarnation, a departure to some shadowy existence. We join the force, become one with nature. You know, whatever your answer would be is based on your worldview. Number five, how is it possible to know anything at all? How is it possible, or why is it possible to know anything at all? I'm going to teach you a philosophical word here. This will be fun. Okay. The philosophical word is epistemology. Epistemology. There's a Greek word which sounds like kind of a bad word, pistuo, which means to believe. And it's based on that same root word, epistemology, which is to know something. And so epistemology is a branch of philosophy in which they study how we can know anything at all. How can I know that there's a podium in front of me? You may say by touching it and seeing it. And so that would be a sense-oriented way of knowing things, and we do know things through our senses. But can we know anything? Can we know anything not just through our senses? Are there some things we know without using our senses? Okay. What's that?
Logic.
Okay, logic. Is logic scientific? Okay. So there seems, there's some people would say, they would argue with our ability to know things through logic. And they usually do it ignorantly. Stephen Hawking, who's an atheist who's confined to a wheelchair, he has Lou Gehrig's disease, wrote a book a while back called The Grand Design. And in the opening pages of the book, he makes the statement, philosophy is dead. And his point is, science is the only way we know things. Now, let me ask you this. What is the problem? And Chris, you can't answer because you've been around me too much. What is the problem with his agenda to prove that science is the only way to know anything and his statement, philosophy is dead? Yeah.
How do you know? How do you know what you just said?
Okay. Go ahead. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, the statement philosophy is dead is not a scientific statement. So what's that mean? If philosophy is dead, if he's right, then can he know that philosophy is dead?
No.
And so the point here is we have to be careful when people make certain claims. We have to dig deeper to understand that they've actually committed to a certain view of truth and of getting at truth. And if we're not careful, things will seem plausible. And then we dig a little deeper and we see it's not as plausible as at first it seemed. Okay, number six. How do we know what is right and wrong? How do we know what is right and wrong? One philosopher famously made the statement, we cannot derive an ought. What does it mean if you ought to do something?
You should.
Yeah. We cannot derive an ought from an is. What do you think he meant by that? We cannot derive an ought from an is.
In today's translation, atheists can't have any moral thing, anything moral.
Okay. Now, I would say that they can be, can atheists be moral people?
Yes.
Yeah. Now,
but they're inconsistent.
Yeah, good. Very good. All right. We cannot derive an ought from an is. Okay, John Lennox is one of my favorite authors. He's a professor at Oxford University in England. I'm going to be there in 2 weeks. I can't wait to go. I get to teach a class. I'm going to sit in C.S. Lewis's library with one of his few remaining friends, living friends, Walter Hooper, and give a lecture together to our class on C.S. Lewis. I'm mildly ecstatic about this. But John Lennox has three PhDs. He is a philosopher of mathematics, and also he's the head of the philosophy of science department at Oxford University. The philosophy of science department cares not only about what scientists do, but why they think about what they do and the reasons, the foundations for why they do what they do. He gives this example. He says, if you were to scientifically evaluate the components or whatever, the makeup, the chemicals that make up strychnine poison, they could tell you that if you put it in your grandmother's sweet tea, it will kill her. But they cannot tell you why you shouldn't put it in her sweet tea. Science can't tell you that. Because you can't derive an ought, a moral imperative, from an is, a scientific statement of fact. Does that make sense? You can't get an ought from an is. I shared that with one skeptic on one of my trips. I was in Dallas, Texas, and met a guy, and we were talking, and I shared that example, and I said, "You could, science can tell you strychnine will kill your grandmother if you put it in her sweet tea. It can't tell you you shouldn't do it." And he said, and it can't tell you if you should. And I thought, well, I wasn't expecting that response. Hate to be your grandmother. All right. Question number 7. What is the meaning of human history? What is the meaning of human history? Again, these questions don't point to whether or not a worldview is wrong. They're just getting at whether people live with consistency based on their commitments. So what is the meaning of human history? If somebody is an atheist, they ultimately can say that it seems like survival is the ultimate meaning of the universe, or that nothing is. But if they live as though there is meaning to our lives, they have to ask, am I being consistent with that? I was sharing with that. It sounds like all I hang out with are skeptics, and that's not necessarily true, but a good friend I've known for a long time, I was in Houston a couple weeks ago, and he's an atheist, and he shared that was talking about his child, his son, and how much he loves his son. And at one point we had talked about, kind of the what he called cognitive dissonance and what that means. I'll try not to use big words without explaining them. Cognitive dissonance is when you know something, you believe something's true, but it doesn't seem to line up with reality. I've already kind of mentioned that idea. Like the Santa Claus thing, I saw Mama kissing Santa Claus. Something seems wrong with this scenario. And he's asked me, he said, don't you live with cognitive dissonance? You hold to these certain beliefs that, you know, so many scientists don't hold to. And I said, well, do you feel like you live with cognitive dissonance? And I said, you know, ultimately your love for your child is only your evolutionary instinct for your genes to survive. But if that's all it is, then why do we celebrate? I mean, doesn't it seem like your love transcends a mere desire for your genes to survive? So if you live as though there's some overarching purpose that is bigger than nature, is that consistent? Francis Schaeffer believed that there were two major worldviews, the gospel and a philosophy known as nihilism, which we're going to talk about together. Nihilism is based on a Latin word, which is nil. What do you think nil means? Nothing. So have you ever used that expression? What do you get? Nil. Nihilism is a philosophy that says that if there is no God and the universe is this closed system and there's nothing outside of it, there could be no overarching purpose, there could be no significance to human beings, there could be no ability for humans to make meaningful decisions. It's just chemical responses going on in their mind that lead them to do what they do. It ultimately leads to a world without purpose, to nihilism. So he said we have the gospel and we have nihilism. We have Jesus and nothing, or nothing. He would share the gospel with people, kind of using James Sire's approach. And I'm going to wrap up with this illustration and give you the last question and we'll be done. When he would share the gospel with people, he would try to systematically show them that to be consistent with their worldview commitments, generally speaking with atheists, that it leads to a commitment of reality, that there is no meaning, no purpose, no significance. And he would do this. Do you think people would generally feel happy about that realization? He shared the gospel with one young lady. Francis Schaeffer's wife was named Edith, and they had a place called Le Brie and up in the Swiss mountains, and they would let skeptics come and live at their house, and they would have chores. They would have to help garden and help take care of the home, and they could live there. He became a well-known philosopher that people would go to for wisdom, and they could live there as long as they did these chores and as long as they were part of a Bible study every night. And so Francis and Edith Schaeffer would lead these Bible studies, befriend these skeptics, take care of them. And Francis shared the gospel with a young lady one night. And after he shared the gospel with her, she attempted suicide. And his wife, Edith, asked him, Do you think that's a good form of evangelism? You know, you share the gospel with people and they attempt suicide. And Francis Schaeffer said, with a lot of gospel seriousness, this is the only way I feel like we could do evangelism with a skeptic world, is to show them that apart from the gospel, there's no meaning, there's no purpose, there's no way to have truth with certainty. And so, number seven, what's the meaning of human history? If you live as though there's meaning and purpose, you have to be able to explain why. Number eight's really easy, because we've talked about it all the way along, and that is this person's personal and life-orienting core commitments consistent with their worldview? What personal life-orienting core commitments are consistent with this worldview? Again, on page 23 in your book. In other words, let's look at the way you live your life and the things you care about and the aspirations and the hopes and the love and the romance and the splendor and beauty that you look at the universe with. Do all of those things seem to be consistent with your worldview commitments? And if they're not, then let's talk about what core commitments would be consistent with your worldview. So those are Sire's eight questions. We're going to apply it to the gospel and apply it to atheism or naturalism in our time together. I'm going to try to address your questions that you gave a few moments ago. Before we break, are there any questions about what I've talked about thus far? Yes, sir. Yeah, do you have a digital copy that we could email?
My presentation is on YouTube, and I can email you my paper if you'd like.
Yeah, could you give... Chris, come on up here really quick. I think it's worthy of applause. He didn't do it for that, but... Chris is headed to Purdue, right? And you're going to study engineering. Mm-hmm. And then after that, plans to go to seminary. And so be praying for Chris. That is the first of many opportunities you'll have to share the gospel with skeptics on your way to Purdue. We have a student who's in our worldview program named Evan, mm-hmm. who's heading to Purdue.
Yeah, I know him.
Okay.
Yeah, I met him here last week.
Very cool. So say whatever you want to about the whole process and give them your contact info.
Okay. So basically, I don't know if everyone here has heard of International Baccalaureate, but my school did a program similar to that, and we just choose a topic and write a research paper, like have a professional mentor write a research paper and do the presentation. So you could do whatever you want, and I did mine on the resurrection and why it's like historically certain, and it can be verified through history and historical documents. So I did that, and that also gave me the opportunity to share the gospel with my very secular school. If you want to watch it on YouTube, it's The Resurrection of Jesus by Christopher Morgan. It's about an hour and 40 minutes with like introduction at the beginning and questions at the end. The actual presentation is about an hour. And my paper is a lot more detailed than the actual presentation, but it would just take a lot longer to read. I had poor time planning, so I didn't really have time to edit it. So the content is good, but I think it's a little rough around the edges. But if you'd like me to email to you, just email me at dchristophermorgan@gmail.com. My first name's David, so dchristophermorgan, CHRISTOPHER, and then MORGAN, @gmail.com, and I'd be happy to get that to you.
Awesome. Thanks, Chris.
Thanks.
I'll have you share more at some point, because I'm sure you guys would love to ask Chris some questions and stuff. Did you have a question? Yeah, I think that anything that... So his question is about Greek mythology, but the bigger question would be, can anything that comes from chaos lead to something with meaning? Does that make sense? So whether it's Greek mythology or something else. And I would say it's if everything's the result of mindless, impersonal matter, then it's really hard to derive an objective basis for meaning and purpose. If everything's the result of chaos, then it's very difficult to say there's something outside other than chaos that would bring in meaning or purpose. So if it's from chaos, then everything ultimately, even if it seems like there's meaning or purpose, it's chaos as well. So that's a really short answer, but hopefully that helps a bit.
So Greek mythology
Francis Schaeffer would argue that every worldview apart from the gospel leads to nihilism. So he'd have a much more detailed way that he would show how postmodernism leads to nihilism or Greek mythology would lead to nihilism. But yeah, apart from a God who is there and who is not silent, we it's impossible that we'll have certainty or purpose. I mean, that's my firm belief, and I hope that we get to see that a little more as we go through this. Yeah. Yes, sir. Yeah, I think that because they don't live, you know, secular humanism, you have like fundamentalist atheists, and some of you guys have talked about combative atheists, and they are of the fundamentalist variety. They're actually losing influence and becoming less popular. And so what's kind of on the rise is a return to secular humanism, which secular humanism, let me define a couple terms really quick. When I say secular, I mean an explanation of reality with no reference to religion. Does that make sense? So if something's secular, it's religion-free, or it claims to be. Now, secularism and secularization, all these other terms kind of have different meanings, and they become a religion in and of themselves. But secular humanism is a belief system or a movement even of atheists, people who don't believe in God, or agnostics, people who are pretty sure there's not a God, who want some kind of community and religion. So in Boston, Massachusetts, last week, they launched a church for atheists. And the pastor of that church, well, he's not the pastor, but Greg Epstein is one of the leaders. He's the secular humanist chaplain at Harvard. And so if secular humanism is religion for atheists, community for atheists, support group for atheists, then it makes sense that they would have a church. I was actually in Boston. I met with Greg's assistant while I was there, who just published a book called Faithiest. And it's people who are atheists, but they like elements of faith. So how might they answer meaning and purpose? They would say, you create your own meaning and purpose. So we don't need some objective, overarching purpose. We can create it for ourselves. And that's usually associated with a philosophy known as existentialism. And so the main goal of existentialism is to escape nihilism. And so nihilism is there's no meaning. Existentialism is we can create it for ourselves. And I think they would say, you know, as you look at history, it seems like our species does better when we get along. It does better when we care for our family units. And so we have these reasons for community and caring for each other. Evolution teaches us these things. And so that might be some of the response that I've heard. And I think Schaeffer would try to say, but do you have a foundation for that? I'll close with one quote. Francis Schaeffer said, secular humanists have their feet firmly planted in midair because they have nothing to stand on. So that doesn't mean they wouldn't give an answer for why they care about things, but Schaeffer would say they have no foundation for their beliefs. All right, I'm really looking forward to this. I hope this didn't bore you too much. If I say anything that doesn't make sense, please raise your hand and stop me. I would rather cover less material, make sure you understand it, then get through everything. All right, I will see you later this afternoon. You guys are dismissed.